cosmic bowling in the studio tonight. A fuse is out or something. I don't know what's going on in this building right now. Our computers are on. The broadcast antenna apparently has juice because you're hearing us, right? But the lights are off in the building. Very strange. Now, I like to keep the lights low in the building. I like to have this kind of third shift sort of evening casual atmosphere in the studio to kind of fuel my mentality going into the program. But this is a little absurd. Like, I can't see the keyboard. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what effect, if any, this has on our show this evening. And, of course, it happens in an equally awkward context of yet more allegations of sexual misconduct from more figures in the culture. Garrison Keillor and Matt Lauer both ousted from their respective jobs after allegations have surfaced. Now, both of these cases strike me from what I've read so far. And, you know, that's the thing, is that it's hard to, there's such a rush to try to jump to a conclusion in these instances and to have a solid opinion that, you know, to come down with the guilty verdict or the innocent verdict or to take sides or whatever the case may be. The fact of the matter is, the rational approach to this is we have to take a look at the evidence as it emerges, as it's presented to us, in full context, and reserve our judgment, or at the very least qualify our judgments with the fact that we don't know everything, right? That said, with that big asterisk, these two cases look very different to me. In fact, they look like polar opposites.
That's fair.
You know, like the Garrison Keillor thing, and I want to start off with examining that story. I find myself more sympathetic to him than I have been to any other figure who has faced accusations thus far, based upon how he's responded to it. Because his response, if it's to be believed, which that's the thing, is that there are a lot of aspects of this I want to break down tonight. But one of the aspects that I think needs to be challenged is there's this meme, this theme, you could say, that has been embraced in this wave of sexual misconduct allegations in recent weeks, that the women, the accusers, must be believed. They must be believed on their face, at face value, and you cannot question their integrity or their credibility whatsoever, and that to do so is to re-victimize them automatically, right? Well, that strikes me as an irrational standard. Of course you can question a claim that somebody makes, particularly when the stakes of that claim is somebody else's reputation, somebody else's career, in some cases, other people's freedom. I mean, if the accusation arises to the level of a crime, then you're talking about potentially somebody being able to remain free in order to own their life and conduct themselves in a manner that they choose. You know, so the stakes are pretty high here. But that said, if you were going to apply that standard of you must believe the woman, well, why? Like, why must you believe her and not believe the guy? There's no real rationale that's been offered for this, at least that I've encountered. And, you know, if you're going to accept at face value what the women are saying, then it strikes me that you would also accept at face value what the men are saying. And in the example of Keillor, you know, he's basically saying this is a extreme overreaction on the part of National Public Radio to an incident that didn't come anywhere close to resembling any sort of sexual misconduct whatsoever.
Well, it's not even what the man and the woman are saying, it's what other people are saying. I heard an interview on another station today that talked to some people that he worked with on A Prairie Home Companion, mm-hmm. and they were like, I was totally shocked. This was
right.
out of the blue. Whereas right. with Harvey Weinstein
right.
and Matt Lauer,
yes.
both of these are like, yeah, oh yeah, we totally knew that guy was a pervert.
Yes.
Whereas this one is like, what? I had no idea.
Right. And we talked about that last night, that you can, you know, because that's the thing, is this idea that all accusations are on even footing is simply not true. You know, when you have a scenario where the anecdotes and the reputation, the collective reputation or the nexus of anecdotes corroborates what the person is being accused of doing or the pattern of behavior that the person is accused of exhibiting, then that's what you, that lends to the credibility of the accusation. But in Keeler's case, the opposite seems to be true. Like, his reputation is one of being rather dull, right? Like, the last guy, in the way he describes himself is the last guy who's going to hug somebody, right? Like, not an affectionate person, certainly in the context of the workplace he's talking about. You know, like, I'm sure in his personal life is a different story. But in the context of his workplace, you know, and look, I definitely fall into that category myself. Like, I'm not going around hugging my coworkers, right? Like, I'm the type of person where when the clock is punched, I'm gone. Like, there's no lingering. There's no, for the most part, going out for drinks or having any sort of extended relationship past getting the job done. And, you know, it's just part of that is just personality style. But the fact remains that the guy had a reputation for being that way, for not being the kind of guy who's going to go out on a limb and engage in the type of behavior that, say, Al Franken has been accused of engaging in, or Roy Moore has been accused of engaging in, or Matt Lauer now has been accused of engaging in. And the Lauer story, by contrast, seems to be one where, similar to Roy Moore, similar to, say, Dan Schoen, or who's the Republican guy who just announced?
Cornish?
Yeah, Cornish, Tony Cornish. So, you know, with those guys, there is a broader series of evidences that you can consider which corroborate the general notion that they were behaving inappropriately to one degree or another. Closing Argument, by the way, is the name of the program. My name is Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Appreciate you tuning in. You can join us tonight, 651-989-5855. Brad Omlin in the control room, taking those calls, producing the program. So the report from the Star Tribune: Garrison Keeler, whose soothing voice and gentle humor helped define the world's view of Minnesota, has been dropped by Minnesota Public Radio for inappropriate behavior toward a coworker. NPR said Wednesday it is severing all ties to the longtime host of radio's A Prairie Home Companion, the show which he handed off last year to handpicked successor Chris Thiel, will be retitled. They got to change the title of the show over this. That's ridiculous. Keeler holds the trademark, and his broadcast no longer will be aired. Well, maybe that has something to do with it, the legal requirements. Officials at the network would not comment beyond a statement saying they were notified last month of allegations relating to Keeler's conduct while he was responsible for producing Prairie Home Companion. So here's what Keeler had to say in response to this accusation. He says, "I put my hand on a woman's bare back. I meant to pat her back after she told me about her unhappiness, and her shirt was open and my hand went up at about 6 inches. She recoiled. I apologized. I sent her an email of apology later, and she replied that she had forgiven me and not to think about it. We were friends. We continued to be friendly right up until her lawyer called." Now, this strikes me as a fairly credible story, right? Like, the idea that, because as far as I know, we have not heard any sort of details regarding what his behavior actually was. Right. So if we learn after this that, in fact, he's been accused of doing all sorts of things above and beyond trying to pat a woman on the back, then we'll have to take those claims under consideration. But for the time being, based upon the evidence that we've been presented with to date, as of today, this strikes me as utterly absurd. If this is the thing that happened, if this is the accusation, he touched my back. What? Like, this is. Let me tell you what it feels like right now. And I think this is true of the NBC thing. Matt Lauer is NBC, right? Like, see, I don't watch any of these shows, so I don't know who's with what or whatever. The NBC thing, the NPR thing, it now feels like it's become trendy to have a scalp. It's become trendy to have your own scapegoat in your own organization that you can trot out and sacrifice in the name of signaling the virtue of your solidarity with the victims, right? Like, everybody, every organization, anybody who's anybody has to find somebody that they can trot out as a abuser of women to one degree or another and sacrifice them publicly so that we can all, you know, dance around and have this tribal ritual of solidarity over our communal rejection of the abuse of women. Now, I don't say that to discount the weight and the legitimacy of some of these claims, much of these claims. There is a there. And I think the danger that we can tend to fall into in this culture that we have where you're pushed to be on a side of a issue and to stake out a position and to just stay there in spite of any evidence that emerges after the initial report. It is important to recognize that there have been incidents, and some of these accusations are more credible than others, and to the extent that they are credible, they ought to be taken seriously, and in many cases, it was appropriate to fire whoever the person was, or for the person to resign from whatever position they hold, or whatever the case may be. But the notion that, and I feel like we're quickly approaching this point, the notion that if you are accused, you should just lose your job automatically, right? Or if you are accused, you must resign now. Like that the only, we've distilled the whole process down to all somebody has to do is make the accusation and then it's just open and shut. We accept the accusation at face value. There's no further consideration given to, you know, whether or not it's credible, whether or not it's corroborated, whether or not there is a context in which the accusation makes any kind of sense. We're just going to automatically fire the person. And that's what it sounds like happened to Garrison Keillor.
It sounds like he just made a mistake. I mean, we don't know what his intent, like, what was going through his mind at the time, because obviously he said, I'm not a touchy person.
Right.
But then he touched this woman.
Right.
But it was like they both accepted it as just a mistake and moved on with their lives
right.
until this point.
Right.
So it, like, again, with Roy Moore, with Harvey Weinstein, with Louis C.K., they knew what they were doing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And the spectrum, you know, another thing we have to keep in mind here is that there's a spectrum of intensity or there's a word that I'm thinking of that I can't quite grasp out of my mangled thoughts right now, but a spectrum of severity.
Yeah.
In terms of what people have been accused of. You know, Roy Moore, on one end of the spectrum, has been accused of molesting teenage girls as young as 14 years old. That is one end of the spectrum in terms of if the accusation is true, that is horrendous. It's a crime. He absolutely positively should not be serving in the U.S. Senate. Yeah, he should be in jail, right, if that's true. On the other end of the spectrum, you have this thing with Garrison Keillor, where if the accusation, if this is what happened, then, you know, I can't quite paraphrase the way I heard it phrased on social media today, but people have lost their minds. If this is the point where we're at, where you can't even reach out and touch somebody in an innocent gesture of human solidarity with what it is that they're going through without fear that you will at some point in the future be accused of being a sexual predator, then we've reached a point at which a level of absurdity which in actuality endangers real victims. Because what's going to quickly happen is you're going to get an overreaction to where people are so sick of it. They're so sick of the hair trigger of accusations of sexual misconduct that they're going to become desensitized to it. And they're not going to want to listen when somebody with an actual case presents it, which is not something that we should want to see. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. There's been a sense expressed by many, including myself, ever since this flood of sexual misconduct allegations has begun, that we are witnessing something that is ramping up toward, if not has already become, a witch hunt. And by that, of course, we mean an irrational crusade to find the guilty and to trot them out and publicly sacrifice them, right? To burn the witches, so to speak. And, you know, I've expressed that fear on the program, that potential that could arise. But I do so in a muted fashion, because the fact of the matter is that a lot of these accusations are credible. A lot of these stories have some weight to them. And depending upon exactly what it is that people are being accused of, in some cases, you know, you're talking about things that, if true, would be regarded as crimes and properly ought to be taken seriously. And so, you know, it's a case where, unlike a literal witch trial or a literal witch hunt, where you're hunting something that does not actually exist, right? Like there aren't women out there communing with the devil who are going to destroy the village by doing so. This is something where the thing being searched for does actually exist. There are sexual predators among us. There are people who engage in sexual misconduct. And so, you know, when to some extent or another, the witches are real, you have to accept that possibility. That said, it's also true. Two things can be true at the same time. It can be true that there are real incidents of sexual misconduct taking place, and it can also be true that the pursuit of such people has gotten out of control and become something that resembles a witch hunt, and that we're now going to start firing people like Garrison Keillor based upon loose, poorly detailed, and apparently unsubstantiated accusations that he engaged in behavior that on its face isn't even really sexual misconduct. Patting a gal on the back? Really? Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson. Let's go to Jeff in Rosemont. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Walter.
Yeah.
Say, I think you're close but not 100% correct with Garrison Keillor in, you know, in and of the fact that NPR has stayed silent about what they know, right? So at this point, the only thing we know is what Garrison Keillor is saying, which, frankly,
right,
he's been working the press for a long time. That doesn't surprise me. With NPR being silent and taking the appropriate approach of saying, hey, we've got our own investigation, we have our own lawyers, and we're going to handle this as workplace misconduct, I think they're doing it right. So I would be cautious of saying, you know, we know all the facts here, because we don't. But I think what's more important to point out is the timing. Right? If you've worked with sexual abuse victims, if their victims get very self-righteous and start going out there saying, well, we're, you know, I'm going to defend another predator, say Al Franken, if you're one of those people who have been abused, you're going to be angry at that. And I think that's really what's happening here with the timing of this particular problem.
I'm not quite sure I follow your last point. So you're suggesting that the decision of the accuser to come out against Garrison Keillor is connected to his defense of Al Franken?
Absolutely. And the reason that I would think that is, you know, here's a person who basically said, hey, look, Al Franken's actions are no big deal. And now you have an accuser who felt that Garrison Keillor's actions were a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You're now motivated to say something. And that tends to make it more believable from my perspective.
So what I find interesting about your first point regarding the lack, you know, having to kind of keep our powder dry and reserve judgment until we find out more, it strikes me that the Keillor accusation is unique amongst those which have emerged, in that we don't know anything. Like the only reason why we only have Keillor's side of the story is because the accuser hasn't disclosed her side of the story, and NPR hasn't disclosed their side of the story, which seems really odd because everyone else has. In all of these instances of accusations, there have been details. There have been names in many cases, if not of the actual accuser, then of people who corroborate the story to one degree or another. And so if that case exists, unless you're talking about criminal action, I don't understand why you would hold back.
Well, and I think that's my point, is that, you know, like, imagine just any private company where an executive is accused of something similar. The company doesn't go to the press and say, here's the accusations, here's why we let this executive go, right?
Right.
I mean, it's treated as an employment matter, which is how many of these things should be treated. You know, if there was something that went on in the workplace, then you need to deal with it under employment law and under the policies of the company. And so from my perspective, I think NPR is doing it right, and a lot of people up to this point have been doing it wrong.
So how has it been done? You're saying the other incidents of accusation other than Garrison Keillor have been done wrong? Or you're saying Yeah.
Exactly. Something like the Matt Lauer thing, right?
Right.
I think it's wholly inappropriate to disclose what they're disclosing publicly. You know, the fact that he was mailing sex toys or whatever to his coworkers.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, put aside the disgusting nature of the accusation, I can't believe that an employer would release that. Right? The statement should be a little more reserved than what we're seeing open in the press today.
Sure.
And I think that gets to your other point, which is there's an agenda at work here, right? People are trying to out-liberal themselves, and that's a challenge as well.
Right.
Well, I don't think it's NBC that's releasing the information, though. People are talking to the people that accused him.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is I'm unaware, and maybe it's buried in one of these articles that I've been skimming over today, but I'm not sure that all of this information is coming directly from NBC so much as it is the press that's been following up with, you know, interviewing people and discovering these stories. You know, if you're looking at Roy Moore, you're looking at Matt Lauer or Al Franken, whatever the case may be, which again, bring me to Garrison Keillor. And maybe it's just that Keillor's not as big of a figure on the public stage as any of these other folks. I mean, you know, we know who he is because we're from Minnesota, but, and, you know, he does have a little bit of a national presence, but not on the level of like a Matt Lauer or whatever. And maybe that's the reason why there hasn't been the same type of press investigation into the credibility or the specifics of the claims. But it still strikes me as noteworthy that there's a lack of detail at this point. And maybe it's because, to your point, Jeff, that their NPR has just been more professional. Maybe I hope that's the case.
Yeah, me too. And look, here's the thing. The challenge with all of these is I believe that what is triggering some of this is the more self-righteous people become about, you know, she must be believed, the more likely they're opening themselves up for attack.
And correct.
I think it's that hypocrisy angle that isn't really talked about, but seems to be triggering a lot of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate your call, Jeff, and your points. Yeah, that's the thing. I'll tell you, you know, on... And I got to be careful about, you know, what I disclose here. Names change to protect the innocent, what have you, but a lot of conversations that have been privy to surrounding particularly the Matt Lauer thing and the details that have come out surrounding the activities that he's accused of being engaged in. At this point, I think a lot of people are taking a look at themselves and their own lives and their own circle of friends and coworkers and their own associations and thinking to themselves, this could be me. Like, this could easily be me. You know, a conversation with coworkers at a bar, after work, the things that get said, the comments that get made, that in the context in which it happens, there is no sense whatsoever of it being inappropriate or crossing some sort of boundary, whatever the case may be. But if you were to take, if there were a court stenographer in the room and you just read a transcript of what was said 6 months later in the newspaper, it would seem very damning, right? And, you know, to what extent is that what's happening right now with somebody like a Garrison Keillor or a Matt Lauer? I don't know. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Fun fact. I was born in Detroit, Michigan. Spent the first 11 years of my life there. And the allegations against John Conyers of sexual misconduct, Democratic representative of the Detroit area, has provided the opportunity for me to view some video of his lawyer talking in Detroit, defending his client. And just, you know, as a total aside, it's nice to see that the place still looks as dingy and gray and colorless and flat as I remember it. That place, I'll tell you what, I've told the story before of moving here when I was 12 years old, 13 years old, somewhere in that zone. And, you know, my dad was scouting out the joint. We moved here for his work, and he came out in order to transition jobs within, at the time, Northwest Airlines. And so, you know, he got a little apartment out here first to kind of scout things out and start his job. And he brought me out, and I remember getting off the plane and coming out of the airport. And it was like that scene in The Wizard of Oz when Dorothy opens the door and it goes from a black and white film to a world of color. Like, that's what it felt like. Complete with the rolling hills and the blue sky and the clouds in the sky and the birds tweeting away. Like, everything just seemed more vibrant and colorful because I had spent my entire life up to that point living in flat, dirty, gray, eternally overcast, dingy Detroit, Michigan.
And then winter came.
And then winter came, yes. Yeah, winter is my reminder of, oh, this is what it was like in Michigan every time that winter hits Minnesota. Because that's the thing about being in the Midwest generally, is that when it's winter, it's just dirty. Just period. Everywhere you go. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. From the Detroit News, U.S. Representative John Conyers has no immediate plans to resign despite growing calls for the Detroit Democrat to step down amid sexual harassment allegations, his attorney said Wednesday. He's not going to be forced out of office, and no one has told him he has to leave, attorney Arnold Reed told the Detroit News. He has not indicated he's going to resign at this point. Three House Democrats have called on him to step down, including Representatives Kathleen Rice of New York, Primala Jilafell of Washington State, and Earl Blumenauer of Oregon. Former U.S. Representative Donna Edwards of Maryland also called Wednesday for the Detroit Democrat to resign. Reed said he met Wednesday with Conyers at the congressman's home. We had a great talk. We talked about how he's doing and how these allegations have affected his family. Reed said the congressman will make any decision he feels is right in due course. The 88-year-old Conyers returned to Detroit on Tuesday night after several congressional Black caucus members reportedly encouraged him to resign amid an ethics probe into the harassment accusations and possible misuse of his office budget to pay out a settlement in 2015. Conyers, the longest-serving member of the House, has vehemently denied the accusations and said he would cooperate with an ethic committee investigation. He stepped down as the top Democrat in the Judiciary Committee on Sunday. Now, for somebody like Conyers, this is like an existential crisis. Like, he's been in Congress, I think I saw in some other article, like 55 years. 55 years in Congress. That's amazing. That's astounding. More than half of a century serving in Congress. I mean, that's his entire identity.
That's 27 elections.
It's insane. The things this guy has to know, the skeletons that he has in various closets, the dirt he's got on other people, it's got to be amazing. And the thing is that, you know, for him, the idea of resigning, the idea of stepping away, because that's the thing, is he has seen the political careers of others begin and end over and over and over again, and he has stood on the sidelines and watched it happen and survived it all. So there has to be some part of him in his psychology that's thinking to himself, this can't possibly be the end. This can't possibly be how I go out. I've been here for 55 years. I've survived. Like, he knows the real dirt on himself. Like, he knows what he has gotten away with, and he's got to be thinking to himself, I've managed to get away with all this, and this is going to bring me down. It's got to be a tough moment. Now, I don't say that in order to sympathize with him in any way, but rather, on the contrary, to highlight how obscene it is that people, politicians, can become an institution unto themselves. You know, be serving for decades in public office. Now, I'm not a big fan of the concept of term limits, generally, in terms of, you know, for the presidency, fine. You know, the existing term limits, I'm not saying we should abolish the term limits that we have, but in terms of having congressional term limits and what have you, it strikes me as too much of a panacea, or an attempt at panacea, where you're basically saying this is going to solve all our problems if we just limit people to one term or two terms or three terms or whatever it is, that's just going to inherently solve problems. It doesn't. It gives you a new set of problems, or a different set of problems than the ones that you currently have.
It would just shift the money or the lobbying.
Right. Yeah. It's all it does is change the dynamic. You're not actually getting to the root of what the problem is, which is, just, you know, as an aside, the amount of power that government has. Okay? That's the problem. The amount of power that government has. That said, it is nonetheless obscene that somebody could be there for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And, you know, I don't know what the solution is to that, but perhaps it's something as simple, you know, to offer a libertarian solution, perhaps it's something as simple as us just developing the cultural disgust with it. and deciding that we're not going to reelect somebody who's been there more than, you know, 8 years or 10 years or whatever the case may be. So along with that update on Conyers' situation, Nancy Pelosi has come under fire by at least one of her Democratic cohort for her response to the accusations against John Conyers. This from Politico. A Democratic congresswoman laced into Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi on Wednesday, suggesting the top House Democrats set women back and, quite frankly, our party back decades by failing to move forcefully to confront allegations of sexual harassment by veteran Democratic Representative John Conyers. Speaking to reporters at the Capitol, Representative Kathleen Rice of New York said Pelosi's appearance on Meet the Press on Sunday, when she raised questions about the accounts of Conyers' accusers and described the Michigan Democrat as an icon, ceded the party's moral high ground on sexual harassment issues, especially because one of Conyers' accusers is bound by a non-disclosure agreement. I think that her comments on Sunday set women back and, quite frankly, our party back decades, said Rice, who is advocating for legislation that would expose a slew of hidden taxpayer-funded settlements for sexual harassment by lawmakers and aides. Rice said Pelosi's comments were particularly egregious in light of President Donald Trump's tacit embrace of Roy Moore, the Alabama GOP Senate candidate accused of molesting a minor. And look, you know, the gal's got a point, right? I mean, we talked about this last night, that we've gotten to a point where political allegiance trumps all. There is no real interest in, like, basically everybody's lying. When they claim to care about, you know, the victims, or they care to claim about decency and family values, or whatever the case may be, well, their talking point, their partisan talking point that they use to try to claim the moral high ground on these allegations of sexual misconduct is basically completely facetious. And that in reality, it all comes down to political advantage. And that's pretty clear. And, you know, the gal's got a point. Now, it shouldn't surprise us at all that the Democrats don't actually have any moral high ground. But, you know, I can make the same lament regarding Republicans. You know, what an incredible opportunity when presented with this scenario, or this kind of advent that we've had, this wave of sexual misconduct allegations. What an opportunity to draw a line in the sand and establish a principle and then make our judgments based upon that principle. But instead, you know, we've chosen to play politics on all sides. And it's a pretty sad testament to where we're at as a culture. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. To join us, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. 651-989-5855, the number to join us. Let's go to Henry in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Walter. How are you doing? How are you doing tonight?
Doing all right.
It's always a pleasure to be on your show. I was wondering, how well do you feel that you know Mr. Keeler in terms of following his career?
Yeah, in passing. Okay. Very, very, very much in passing.
Okay. Well, that was kind of the impression I had, and I just wanted to, you know, clarify that point. I followed him for a long time, and to me, he's kind of an intriguing personality in that, you know, he's had this rather remarkable success carving out this niche for himself, mm-hmm. and I can respect that, but it seems to me over the years, he's kind of been a bit of a prickly personality, somewhat mercurial in terms of his moods. Mm-hmm. And you might know, although you're younger than I am, so perhaps you don't remember, but he quit his show abruptly about 30 years ago. It seemed capriciously to me, and claimed that he was going to be retiring, and then, of course, came back shortly thereafter.
Sure, sure.
And I only bring this up. He also said something that was incredibly outlandish about 15 years ago after Senator Wellstone died in the tragic plane crash. Mm-hmm. He openly and publicly raised the specter that somehow, some way, Norm Coleman was behind that.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. It's just absurd. And I only bring these things up not because it proves the truth or falsity mm-hmm. of these allegations, but I'm just not inclined to take what he says at face value.
Sure.
at this juncture. He certainly deserves due process. I'm totally with you on that. Everyone deserves a right to defend himself or herself. Mm-hmm. Totally with you on that. And I agree. Based upon his account, this seems preposterous what happened to him. But I just, in my gut, and it doesn't mean he's guilty, but in my gut, there has to be more to this story. It has to be. And I think it's interesting that up till now, there doesn't appear to be any leaks from the apparently there are two women.
Right.
There don't appear to be any leaks from their lawyers or their representation. And I think that is the big difference in this story from all these others that have been celebrated, particularly involving media or Hollywood individuals, entertainment figures.
Mm-hmm.
Because there, in those cases, you had media reports that broke the story, whereas this one, it's almost Mr. Keeler, who's kind of breaking the story or breaking whatever news there is, and he's got his spin out. Doesn't mean he isn't telling the truth, but he's got his spin out. And you're right, we aren't able to measure that against the other side, and that's a very unique situation.
Well, and the way you describe Keeler's behavior in the past, his statements and his conduct, it's interesting because it occurs to me that if he is not telling the truth in this instance, that's incredibly ill-conceived, really, really dumb. Because if there's more to this that we haven't heard yet, then he's gonna look really, really bad by coming out and saying, "Oh yeah, no, it was just innocent patting of a gal's back in order to console her, and I didn't realize she had an open shirt in the back and what have you." And if it comes out that there's more to it than that, then he's really kind of kicked himself.
I totally agree with you, Walter, and that is, in terms of a logical, deductive reasoning analysis, that would be a point in Mr. Keeler's favor. On the other hand, though, if you look at it from the point of view of American Public Radio and the local entity, NPR, I believe they had a contract with Mr. Keeler, and if they're firing him without cause, that really opens them up to a tremendous litigation. Now, initially, Mr. Keeler was, given what I know of him, I thought he was remarkably gracious at first. But as he's gone on here, he had a Facebook post this evening that this is the guy I've come to know.
Yeah.
And he seems more angry and bitter about talking about leaving the country.
Sure.
That's a bit of the prickly personality and the moodiness to which I was referring. But, I get your point. It's a very fair point. He's really opening himself up. But on the other hand, I think American Public Radio is opening themselves up to, again, I don't know the terms of his contract that he had, but if they're wrong, in any way, shape, or form, wrongfully terminating him, they are very vulnerable as well.
It doesn't sound like, and granted, he could change his mind or he might not, be totally sincere in what he's saying, but it sounds like he's not interested in pursuing the legal path.
Correct. And that's what I was alluding to when I said that initially. He seemed quite gracious and almost witty in his initial statement.
Right.
I think he sent an email to the Star Tribune.
Right.
But as this day has gone on, he seems increasingly bitter.
Well, here's the thing, though. Like, you put yourself in his shoes.
Yes.
If this had happened to you, and his side of the story was accurate, you are not guilty of anything, and yet you've been fired, your name has been dragged through the mud, your career has ended in the most humiliating manner possible, you're going to be a little upset about it.
Absolutely, which is why it was very striking to me initially when, and you just alluded to it a moment ago, Walter, he said, I don't have his exact statement in front of me, but it was words to the effect of, I'm paraphrasing, that he doesn't feel like arguing about this at age 75.
Sure.
And I'm with you. If I'm innocent, And the story is, as he's described it, which I agree, it's preposterous that they would take this action based upon his account. I'm totally with you on that. Then, yes, he does have every right to be angry and bitter. And at the very, very least, he doesn't need necessarily to pursue some sort of settlement in terms of money. Mm-hmm. But in terms of his reputation, you're right.
Yeah,
he should be in there fighting.
But maybe that's what's happened. That's the thing, is that this is kind of, we got to remember we're talking about a human being here.
Yeah.
And his initial response, may have been one where he was in a certain mood, like maybe he was just in the shock of the moment and was like, okay, I'm going to fall back upon my professionalism, yep, and come out with this statement that sounds really nice. And then as the day goes on, yep, and he's stewing in it, he changes his tone. I mean, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, I think you might very well be correct, and that certainly would not be an unusual reaction in terms of human nature. I just think, would you not agree with me, though, Walter, that we clearly don't know all the story yet?
No, of course not. Yeah. And I, you know, I hope I didn't convey the sense that I was assuming that we know the entire story. In fact, I said at the outset that we always at any given point in these types of situations or any given news story, we always have to be open to the possibility. And particularly in this endeavor that I'm engaged in, you know, where I have to come on the air at a certain time and say something about the things that are happening, we have to be willing to change our position based upon new evidence.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And the last thing I'll say, I know we're at the top of the hour,
yeah,
is I will give Mr. Keeler this much credit. At least he has a defense. Most of these guys, you talked about the idea that there might be a witch hunt going on,
right,
here. Most of these guys don't even have a defense. That's even remotely credible.
Yeah.
And he does have an account, which, if it's true, I think that is a compelling defense. We just need more information to, you know, make a reasonable judgment.
I think we'll get it. I appreciate your call, Henry. I appreciate you listening to the program. When we come back, we'll talk about Donald Trump's latest gaffe fiasco. I don't even know. I don't think you can call it a gaffe when you're trying to do it. When you're purposely get out there provoking. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hatson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So we had a nice conversation with our regular caller, Anthony, last night, trying to get me to understand where people are at, where Trump supporters are at, what their psychology is like, why they like when he does things like the Pocahontas comment at the Navajo Code Talkers event the other day. You know, something like that happens and folks like me look at it askew, raise her eyebrow, and go, wow, that's pretty amazing. That's pretty noteworthy. Not at all what I would expect from the President of the United States. Not the time, place, or manner to say something like that. And folks like Anthony, and perhaps yourself, look at it and go, that's hilarious. I want more of that from my president. That's entertaining. And, you know, I've been thinking about this over the past 24 hours, and Brad and I were having a little conversation off air about it. I can't tell you that that's not a legitimate value. Like, I can't tell you that you shouldn't be looking for entertainment in your president, right? If that's what you want, if that's what you're voting for, if that's what you think is of primary importance, is being entertained or being affirmed in some way by the conduct of the president of the United States, then there it is. That's your value. That's what you care about. I can't tell you you ought to think differently. But I don't understand it. Like, I don't get it. And I don't think I ever will. Like, I'm never going to understand why or how you get to the point where the thing you're looking for from the person who controls one third of the federal apparatus is a good laugh.
Well, to Anthony's point, though, like, it can't get any worse. Like, things would be just as bad with Hillary Clinton, but in a different way.
Yeah.
And even though Trump does it in a, you know, a destructive, a childish way almost, mm-hmm, it's not like it's any worse. There's not a better alternative, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I would go so far as to say that I think we'd be worse off with Hillary Clinton there, because in her case, see, that's the thing, is I hate that binary thinking. And that's what we had with the election, and that's what elections tend to push us towards, is this choice A or choice B type thinking. The reality is the consideration of whether or not your president is serious versus unserious is really separate from the consideration of the policies that they're trying to pursue. And with Hillary Clinton, you might have gotten a more serious president, no doubt, but she would have been working towards an agenda that was horrific and horrible for the country.
Well, and because Trump acts the way that he does, his policies aren't taken seriously.
Sure.
But because Clinton would have acted seriously, there wouldn't have been any questions.
Interesting. I don't think that's wrong. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, and your iHeartRadio app. Two ways to stream the program. You can catch up on the podcasts right there in your iHeartRadio app. Just do a search for Closing Argument. Our past shows will pop up on our channel there in the app. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. The reason I bring this up again is because Trump has a new thing. Of course, because it's a new day, right? So there's a new Trump thing. From BBC News. Oh. The first tweet from Jada Franson, the deputy leader of Britain First, claims to show a Muslim immigrant attacking a man on crutches. This was followed by two more videos of people Ms. Franson claims to be Muslim. Responding to Mr. Trump's post, Trump retweeted these posts. That's the headline here. Trump retweets far-right group's anti-Muslim videos. Responding to Mr. Trump's retweets, UK Prime Minister Theresa May's official spokeswoman or spokesman said it was wrong for the president to have done this. White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders said Mrs. May and other world leaders knew that these are real threats that we have to talk about. Whether it's a real video, the threat is real, she said. The original video was shared by U.S. conservative commentator Ann Coulter, who Mr. Trump follows. Now, This is significantly more serious than the whole Pocahontas thing. The Pocahontas thing was, and I said this last night, okay? It's an amusing thing to talk about, right? It's funny. It's noteworthy just because of who it is. It's the president of the United States and how frustrated and upset people get about it. But this is actually serious because embedded within this controversy over these retweets is an actual issue. And that is the issue of Islamic extremism and terrorism that is fueled by extremist Islamic ideology. That is a real issue that we need to discuss in a serious manner. And, you know, the danger when I criticize Donald Trump for being less than serious, I think, you know, why that's important to me and why it's more important to me than whether or not he's entertaining or whether or not he ticks off the right people or whatever the case may be, is because it, by being non-serious in incidents like the Pocahontas thing, it takes away from the credibility of his focus on real problems like Islamic terrorism. What folks can do is they can dismiss the concern over what this ideology is producing in the world globally by just wrapping it up in the package deal of, oh, that's just Trump and Trump's Twitter account and, you know, who Trump is retweeting and what have you. And what it ends up doing is it ends up selling short the message that's an essential message, that this is a real threat that we ought to take seriously and ought to do certain things about. Let's go to Renee in Bloomington. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. So I kind of categorically disagree with you on the whole Trump being an entertainer thing, and that's the reason why people are supportive of him.
Well, that's what was told to me.
We've made fun of politicians being these, you know, weak-kneed, never tell you what they think, never tell you where they stand people who, even if you really support their speech when they win a nomination or when they win an election, you know that deep down inside, one-tenth of what they said is correct, and they're just not going to do anything that they told you they're going to do. They're just going to do whatever they need to do to continue being reelected.
Mm-hmm.
With Trump in there, people genuinely feel that he is being serious when he says these things, and he actually does believe these things. The Pocahontas deal, I applaud that because the ridiculousness is that everyone seems to give a pass to how basically she used a protected test class to elevate her own career. And frankly, she's going after him as on a tirade, you know, continuously. You're going to do a character assassinate the president, he can come right back at you. But before, we would not have that. We wouldn't have Bush or Obama or any of these other presidents ever respond to that. Now people have somebody that they feel like, okay, I would respond to it the same way, or I'd have the same kind of reaction to it. I don't think it's a bad thing. I just think it's a change in the demographic of people don't buy into the fake politician anymore. And if they did, Hillary would still be would be president right now.
So there's a couple things I find interesting about your comments here. First of all, what you take categorical exception to is not an idea that I forwarded, but an idea that was given to me as an explanation for why people support Trump by a Trump supporter last night. And it's quite possible and indeed likely that Trump supporters have different reasons for why they support the president. But in the case of Anthony, it was, I'm entertained by this guy. This guy makes me laugh. This guy says things that I would say, or that people that I know would say, in that situation, and makes me feel like I'm being represented in that kind of cathartic way in that moment. Now, you know, that's how he feels about it. You feel differently. Both of those things can coexist at the same time. What I find more interesting is this notion, though, of, because I agree with you. Like, I think that you're right, that people do feel as though Trump is serious, quote unquote, in the sense that he actually wants to accomplish the things that he says he's going to do. But as far as actually analyzing that notion, how serious can the guy actually be? I mean, what is he doing objectively? What steps is he taking to try to actually advance policy in a meaningful manner? What has he done? What has he even proposed legislatively? What is he down there in Congress trying to hammer out in order to enact this agenda? It seems to me that he is just as fake as a Hillary Clinton or a George W. Bush or anybody else. It's just he does it differently. He sells it in a different manner.
I can see that, and I can concede the point that it was somebody else's position, so I do apologize for the whole disagreement with you.
No, that's fine.
But like anyone who has been in business, and anyone who has been in a leadership role that hasn't been predicated on being reelected to a government office, he delegates responsibility. He's essentially allowing people that he's brought into his administration to come up with a tax plan, come up with infrastructure, come up with these other ideas. He's essentially delegated responsibility, which mm-hmm. is what we really want from a president, because frankly, when a president comes out and says, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z,
mm-hmm.
it never gets done. It's just fodder for their, it's fodder for their, you know, their echo chamber, their hardcore followers. And we all know it never will get done. They really have no power. They have to rely on Congress to do it.
I don't know that that's true. I mean, Barack Obama said he was going to fundamentally transform America. He said he was going to pursue, to some degree or another, nationalized healthcare, and he did those things. Like, he got in office and he had an agenda, he had a plan. He also delegated authority, but the difference is he delegated within a framework of a plan. He said, this is what I want to do, and I'm identifying that these are the people who can help me do it in these particular areas. Whereas with Trump, I feel as though what he tries to do is, you know, he has this general kind of vague vision of what he wants to accomplish. And then he just hires people and tells them to go do it, with the strategy being, if they succeed to some visible degree, then I'll take credit for it. And if they fail, then I'll just fire them and say they were the wrong person for the job.
I can't disagree with you on that. But now the question about the fundamentally changing America from the previous administration, and how really successful that was, that you're looking at right now, essentially the dismantling of the systems put in place, the offices put in place,
mm-hmm.
bit by bit. There wasn't a solid foundation to that. That
sure.
was almost superficial outside sure. of the healthcare one, which I will agree, that did change everything to a horrible degree.
Right.
But in terms of regulations and environment, in terms of biggest business regulation,
right.
in terms
right.
of everything that they wanted to essentially feed their base with,
sure.
these were just token gestures that were never a fundamental change. They were just there.
That's a fair point. I can't disagree with you. And in fact, that's a large part of the reason why Trump can, to some extent, claim that he's accomplished things despite having no actual legislation that's passed through Congress, because he was able to effectively undo the entire Obama legacy with a phone and a pen, because all of Obama's legacy was with a phone and a pen. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Appreciate your call, yes. Renee. Appreciate you calling in. All right, so, you know, when we return, I want to delve a little bit deeply back into, you know, the recent retweets here from Trump regarding Muslim treatment, alleged Muslim treatment of innocents in Europe, and try to parse through what's real here, what's fake, and the extent to which the mainstream media and the left is trying to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. It's not as though I disagree with Donald Trump on his goals, many of his goals. Some of them I do. And I'm not a national populist. I'm a conservative. My opinions have not changed. My desires, my goals for government have not changed over the past 10, 15, 20 years. I still believe in the same things and still fight for the same things that I fought for in 2008, 2009, 2010 when I was involved with the Tea Party. What has changed is the focus of the Republican Party. What has changed is what's being advocated for by the standard bearer of that party. But be that as it may, there certainly is overlap. There are certainly things that Trump wants to do and things that he wants to advance that I'm entirely for. And it's to that it's on those points. It's on the things that I agree with him on that I find my highest level of frustration, because I feel as though he could be effective in actually changing policy for the better if he conducted himself differently. And an example of that is this latest kerfuffle that has emerged regarding his retweets of some folks over in Europe who are not particularly fond of Muslim immigrants. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. To reset here from the Star Tribune, stoking the same anti-Islam sentiments he fanned on the campaign trail, President Donald Trump on Wednesday retweeted a string of inflammatory videos from a fringe British political group purporting to show violence being committed by Muslims. The tweets drew a sharp condemnation from British Prime Minister Theresa May's office, which said it was wrong for the president to have done this. May spokesman James Slack said the far-right Britain First group seeks to divide us through use of hateful narratives which peddle lies and stoke tensions. Brushing off the criticism in an evening tweet, Trump said May, instead of focusing on him, should focus on the destructive radical Islamic terrorism that is taking place within the United Kingdom. Now, the problem here, as I see it, as somebody who actually agrees with Trump, generally speaking, on this issue, is not that he tweeted something out about it. It's that he tweeted the specific thing that he did. It's that he retweeted something from a source that he had not vetted. Here's how I picture this going down. And I'm pretty confident that this is the case, okay? Trump retweets in much the same way that you or I do. He's sitting there scrolling through his phone all casual-like. He sees something that strikes his fancy, and then he just pushes the button. And that is the entire process, right? Like there is no thought put into, is this source verifiable? Do I trust this person that I'm about to retweet? Has this been verified by anyone? How are people going to respond to me, the president of the United States, retweeting this thing? Is this, and here's the point that I think is most important above and beyond all the ones that I've mentioned thus far. How is this going to advance my agenda? How is this going to advance my policies through Congress, get something to my desk that I can sign in order to actually make the world a better place? That's my wish went through his head before he pressed sends. But I don't think that's what happens. I think it's much more, you know, just that kind of casual flipping through the phone. Oh, I like that retweet, which I can do that, right? Because the things that I retweet have no consequence whatsoever to anybody other than myself and in a small circle of influence that I happen to have. When you assume these greater responsibilities, part of the price you pay for taking on a larger degree of public responsibility is that you don't get to act in that kind of frivolous manner on social media. You actually have to think about what the effects of the things that you say are going to be. Now, Brad brought up yesterday this idea of the medium is the message. And he sent me an article to read on this. And I have to admit, in the time that I had to skim it over, I don't get it.
I understand, because this is something that my media theories professor brought up in college. And I didn't understand it, what she actually meant by it, until like yesterday. And basically, this concept, the medium is the message, was introduced in 1964 by a guy named Marshall McLuhan. And he's kind of just a media theorist, pretty much would be the best way to describe him. And what he says is that the medium ingrains itself in the message. And later in the article, it says, let's see.
He talks about how the nature of the medium itself becomes part of the content of what people are distributing.
It says, this means that people tend to focus on the obvious, which is the content, to provide us valuable information. But in the process, we largely miss the structural changes in our affairs that are introduced subtly or over long periods of time. As society's values, norms, and ways of doing things change because of the technology, it is then we realize the social implications of the medium.
Sure, sure.
So, like, what effect is Twitter having on society as a whole now that presidents are using it to posit policy?
Right, yeah, right. Well, and you could ask the same question about any emergent technology over the years. You know, what effect did the telephone have, or the telegraph, or the radio, or what have you, over how we process information, how we communicate? You know, we cited an article on one of our shows last week to this effect, of talking about how, you know, we're living in a generation where people are processing their perception of the world through digital means in a way that has never happened before, certainly to the extent that it's happening now, and, you know, trying to forecast what's the long-term effect of that going to be.
Well, you think about how the media, or just individual mediums, have affected policy and who is president and what they say.
Right.
Because you think about when radio was introduced, that was the first real, like, mass media.
Mm-hmm.
And in the way that it allowed the New Deal to take shape in the country.
Right.
And then you think to the first election between Nixon and JFK, and how JFK looks so much better on TV than Nixon. And that was the first time that the American public was like, oh, we like this guy.
Right. Yeah.
And just how 9/11, even, everyone was glued to kind of this shock porn on TV.
Yeah.
And we're seeing another advancement like that.
Right.
In the way that a president uses media to affect policy and the country.
Yeah, and we've talked about that before, too, how Donald Trump, and I don't think this is fully appreciated as of yet. I mean, I think it's broadly recognized that Twitter and Trump have a unique relationship, but I think it's much more monumental than people have yet come to realize. Like, we've seen a transition in how politics works that is irrevocable. We're not going back to the way it was before.
Well, it's why the study of history is important, because now, in hindsight, we realize these things and, oh, that's how that works. This is how we have the power of mass media.
Right. Lou, we'll take your call when we return. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Brad Ullman producing the program. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, 651-989-5855, the number to join us this evening. Brad Ullman taking those calls, producing the show. You can catch us streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and on your iHeartRadio app. Let's go to them there phones. Lou in Cross Lake, welcome to the program.
How are you tonight?
Doing all right.
Okay.
What's on your mind?
Yeah, you were talking about Trump's not doing nothing. What is he doing? And, well, he was just over there in China, and the media is not talking about this, but China is going to invest over $83 billion, with a B, into West Virginia, into developing energy in the state, and which is more than that state's entire GDP. And of course, China's also got that BRIC, or that the BRICS going, the Silk Road, and you know, it's, I just find it amazing that the media,
the media, when did Trump
talk about any of that? About how positive that is for the world, what the Chinese are doing, the development that's going on over there, and then how it's spreading throughout the Far East and how other countries throughout Eurasia are jumping on that. And all we hear about is sex scandals and, you know, all this distraction.
So I want to give you a place.
Have you ever been to Executive Intelligence Review? It talks a lot about this. I've got some of these articles in front of me right now, but about what's really going on over there and stuff, and what happened with the talks over there.
Well, I've got a Reuters story in front of me here from a couple of weeks ago, actually. China Energy Investment Corp, the world's largest power company by asset value, has signed a memorandum of understanding to invest $83.7 billion in shale gas, power, and chemical projects in West Virginia, the U.S. state said on Thursday. The agreement was the biggest among a slew of deals signed during U.S. President Donald Trump's state visit to Beijing. The total value of the deals done during Trump's trip could be as much as $250 billion. The gas and power agreement marks the first overseas investment for newly funded China Energy, which formed from a merger of the China Xinhua Group, and it goes on to give some of the details. So there's the corroboration of what it is that you're saying as to, you know, where the media's focus is. I mean, I think that's obvious as to...
I think that maybe, yeah, you can look for it. It's on the back page, but you're not getting that every day on the media.
No.
All you're getting is all the witch hunt stuff.
True.
And the witch hunt stuff, I mean, you can just imagine. You're talking about your concern about the witch hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, imagine where the witch hunt can go with, I mean, we can get into other things. We can go into, in fact, I don't even want to say it on air.
Yeah.
But we could, I'm not even going to say it.
All right. I'll accept that your point has been made.
Okay.
All right. I appreciate you calling, Lou. The thing of it is, you know, when I lament Trump's capacity to quote unquote get things done in the scope of his role as president of the United States. Listen, you know, Lou's got a point. You know, I was unaware of this. This article's from November 9th, right? So that's weeks ago. I don't remember seeing it, you know, and it certainly wasn't being talked about. And it's not insubstantial. You know, China deciding they're going to invest billions of dollars in West Virginia, not insubstantial.
Well, part of the reason is just it's hard to understand what's going on in Asia.
Yeah.
As Americans, we don't care.
And as media, it's not particularly sexy, right? But to my point, this is still not legislation. This is still not policy. And unless the case you're going to make is Trump's going to make America great again by, you know, going around country to country and cutting deals for them to invest in the several states, then at some point, a bill has to be signed and become law. Like, at some point, the law has to change in order to actually bring about a difference in how government works. Let's put it this way. You're not going to drain the swamp, right? The concept of draining the swamp is really kind of, it's monumental in the same sense. And, you know, unfortunately, this isn't the first time I've made a comparison between Trump and Obama tonight. But it's monumental in the same sense that the promise to fundamentally transform America was. You know, when Obama said, we're going to fundamentally transform the United States of America, he was promising systemic change that was going to forever change how business is done in this country. Donald Trump's promise to, quote, drain the swamp, unquote, is similar, if only in that very specific sense, that what he's promising is to change how things are done in Washington, D.C. You cannot have change on that scale, on that level, with that type of lasting impact without actually passing a bill. And that's the problem. Is, you know, I don't think that it's, you know, there's a level of malice that, and this is what I'll grant to the point that was made earlier by one of our callers. If you want to talk about fake politicians and disingenuous politicians, you know, and career folks like Hillary Clinton and whatnot. There's a degree of malice in their misrepresentations. Like they're trying to, what they're trying to hit is a sweet spot whereby they can get you to vote for them without having to actually deliver, right? Like, it's how much can I promise and how little do I have to deliver in order to get to that sweet spot where you will keep voting for me. That's how the typical politician thinks. Now, I will grant you that Trump has a totally different approach, right? Like, for him, he also wants to get elected, right? He also wants to get your support. And he wants to deliver, but he doesn't have... that's the difference, that he actually does want to deliver. The problem is he doesn't seem to have either the grasp on how to, or having thought through a plan of how to actually make it happen. And so it's kind of like, you know, you're gaining one thing that you really want, which is a type of sincerity that you get, this authenticity that we always talk about when we're analyzing Trump. You get a type of sincerity, which is welcome and that people really are hungry for, but you lose the seriousness in terms of actually having a strategic approach to statecraft, to advancing legislation, to changing policy. And you really, you have to have both of those things. You have to have the sincerity coupled with the capacity and the endowment, the ability to act in an effective way in the role that you've assumed. And that's what we're missing, unfortunately. Let's go to Mike in Farmington. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Walter. I guess I look at how he's using that phrase, drain the swamp, and maybe trying to educate people as to really what kind of culture there is in Washington where things don't really seem to get done, and we could even point back to the elections where the people gave the Republicans control and things just didn't seem to happen. And I think part of the change that needs to happen is people need to be aware of the culture and kind of the do-nothing Washington crowd, at least for the middle class and people in the country that are just frustrated that things don't seem to be getting done. They're all well taken care of, and their caps are all well feathered and washed.
Right, right.
But meanwhile, the people in America seem to kind of get left behind. So I think part of it is just to put that focus and draw people's attention to it. That yeah, it is kind of a swamp. They get up there, they get stuck, they morph into just people. I mean, Conyers has been there what, 5 decades?
Yeah, McCain. Right. Yeah,
I mean, right. It's, you know, it is a swamp. They just never seem to get out of the swamp.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, you're right. And yeah, unfortunately, you know, without getting too specific in ways that would be costly, we've all seen that happen to people, right? Like we've all seen people who we wanted to trust or maybe did trust, who we send to these jobs in public office only to watch as they are assimilated. And I don't think it's always out of a malice or deceit on their part, or that they're, you know, somehow two-faced or hypocritical. I think a fair amount of the time people go into these positions or seek these positions, public office, with a sincere desire to actually make a difference and to actually change things, only to discover upon getting elected that the means to do so simply does not exist. And, you know, to the extent that we need to be aware of that as a prerequisite to taking whatever action is necessary to change it, then perhaps Trump has provided us with an essential step in the right direction.
And I'd like to make a request, and it would be interesting from an insider's perspective, if you could actually get Jason on, and Jason Lewis, and have him talk about maybe his perceptions going in,
right,
what he's seen from the inside.
Right. I don't know what kind of answer I would get. You know what I'm saying? Like, how does he answer that question sincerely and forthrightly in a way that doesn't damage him? You know what I'm saying? I don't know the answer to that. Now, that's not a reason to not ask the question. I'm just saying, like, it's you. And this is indicative of the swamp that you're talking about. I appreciate your call, as always, Mike. This is indicative of the swamp that you're talking about, is that you can't even really address it. You can't even really talk about it from the inside without being marginalized and therefore becoming a victim of it. Like, in other words, the type of change that needs to occur is revolutionary. It's monumental. We have to change something on like a constitutional level at this point in order to get this train back on the rails. Closing argument. My name is Walter Edson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Can't explain all the feelings that you're making me feel.
So my schedule is such that really the only way for me to, quote, read, unquote, books is to listen to audiobooks. And, you know, there's upsides to that, of course, you know. And it opens up the context in which you can read your book, as opposed to just, you know, being able to sit down and open the physical thing and actually read it. But the downside is that you can't really go at your own pace, right? And so when you get into something that's deep, you get into something that's heavy, it can be a little bit overwhelming. And I'm reading a book right now that fits in that category. It's something that's been recommended by Glenn Beck, who, of course, you can hear over this very air on a weekday basis. It's called The Fourth Turning. And the idea behind the book, you know, in short, is that there are kind of cultural seasons that we go through on a generational basis. And it follows about a 100-year cycle. And, you know, I'm not gonna break it all down for you because, quite frankly, I don't understand it all. But the notion is that there's a certain zeitgeist, a certain spirit of the time that dominates each progressive generation, and that it goes in this kind of predictable cycle every 100 years or so, and it's broken up roughly into 25-year seasons or segments or turnings. And it's an interesting book, it's an interesting idea, because what it suggests is that what appears to us to be kind of a chaotic pursuit or unfolding of history, where things change inexplicably and we don't understand why, or we don't understand where it's all going, that if you zoom out and you actually take a longer term view of it, you can kind of start to identify trends and identify a rhyme and a reason to at the very least explain why things are happening the way they are, why the culture is changing in the way that it is, and that it has all, to one extent or another, happened before. Right. Even though the technology changes and a lot of the contextual stuff changes, the psychology of how we approach it as human beings goes in this kind of cyclical fashion. And when I contemplate that in the context of, you know, what our caller was just saying regarding Donald Trump and how times are a changing, and there's this expectation, you know, a lot of the theme that seems to emerge from a lot of the calls that I take about Donald Trump is that people's expectation of their representatives, of their politicians, is changing. And that what has worked in the past is not going to work in the future. And I wonder to what extent, you know, some of it I think has to do with technology. It has to do with the 24/7 news cycle. It has to do with Twitter and what have you. But I wonder to what extent it has to do with this concept of the turnings, of this sort of 100-year cycle of the mood of the culture changing on a generational basis. Have we reached a point where people's expectations are shifting in a generational sense, and we're about to have, you know, a new 20-25-year cycle of a different kind of politics as a result? You know, I think that's a real possibility. And the reason why is because you don't just see it in politics. You see it in commerce as well. You know, right now there's this scandal going on amongst gamers, video gamers, because this game that came out, a new Star Wars game that Electronic Arts EA put out, and it's got this functionality within it called loot crates. And basically, in short, the way it works is that you spend a certain amount of in-game currency in order to open these loot crates, which have random items in it of varying value. And there are people who are pushing back against this. This has been a trend in games. You know, any game that you play on your phone, you know, this idea of a freemium game where, you know, it's free to play, but in order to actually advance in any significant way, you end up having to invest money into it. Well, that is starting to creep its way into full-blown AAA retail games, and consumers are pushing back against it in spite of the fact that they have endured it and tolerated it up to this point for many, many years. And it's interesting because it's reflective to me, or indicative to me, of the same type of pushback we're seeing politically, where the things that people have allowed to slide up to this point, and we also see it with all these sexual misconduct allegations, right? Where a pattern of behavior that has been accepted for a very long time has suddenly become unacceptable. The rules have suddenly changed, and there is a new expectation. It's happening in commerce. It's happening in entertainment. It's happening in politics. What does it all mean? Well, I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. Let's go to Corey in Bloomington to close out the show this evening. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, I want to talk about Al Franken.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think he should resign?
Yeah, I do. But I think it's interesting because you called me last night talking about Roy Moore saying that he should stay in. So what's the difference between Roy Moore and Al Franken?
Well, I think Roy Moore, the voters are going to decide for him.
Sure. No, that's true. I mean, but Roy Moore could pull out of the race. I mean, he could decide he's not going to run and in that sense resign, quote unquote.
Yeah, but I don't think he's going to.
Well, I agree with you on that. I appreciate you calling, Corey, as always. Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's going to either. But the question is what's the standard? You know, is there a standard of behavior? And if so, shouldn't that apply regardless of political convenience on either side? I would like to think so. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. We are here 9 to 11 weeknights. Glenn Beck is next. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.